Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Tonight's guest is Chris Carter, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-815-9756. Or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
Hello, Fran. And I know you were up late last night pulling those raffle winners. I guess.
Oh yeah.
Those at the next break, or you want to?
I think a little later. We'll keep everybody in a little bit of suspense. Although it is up on the website, but it's always exciting when we pull the winners.
See, you've got a bunch of articles sitting on your desk.
I do, because, you know, I've become perplexed over the word mainstream, as in mainstream science, mainstream politics, mainstream this and that. And I'm beginning to believe, or actually this morning I had convinced myself that it's really has become a negative word. It's not something, you know, it used to be, oh, mainstream this, and that's what you looked for. If you were looking for a doctor, you wanted somebody who was mainstream. But nowadays, mainstream is a negative thing, and or it appears to be. And I was looking for some sort of confirmation of that, and I kind of opened up my website to hook into BBS Radio, which, of course, is where we're broadcasting from, and their new line here is, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio. So there you go. But in the mainstream stuff, the thing that struck me most was there's a Dr. John Kovach, who was he's a professor of preventative medicine, and he's been doing a lot of research on cancer. And he was perplexed because he said there's so much cancer that and it cannot fully be explained by the traditional risk factors that we keep spending money on over and over and over. We keep doing these surveys and these tests and this research, and it's always on the same risk factors, genetics, smoking, obesity. So he decided, can't be. We can't keep doing that. And he does his own research, and he comes up with cadmium, and he publishes this stuff. And, of course, right away, where does he get flack from? The American Cancer Society, because they're all cushy in their little mainstream way of taking all the money that comes in and giving it to the same scientists to do the same stuff over and over again, and we're not getting any place. I mean, I remember when I was a little kid, my mother used to go collecting for cancer care, knocking door to door, and people would give her a dime, you know. And here we are, how many millions of years later, and there's no cure. So mainstream is a negative thing. And then we've also come up with other discoveries that are getting pushed aside in the name of mainstream science. They recently discovered a bacteria that actually can survive on arsenic. And we were taught growing up that in order to have life, you had to have the same six elements all along. You had to have carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur in order to have life. But this thing is existing on arsenic.
Right.
And, of course, they want to poo-poo this guy because it's not mainstream.
Well, there must be something wrong with methodology, you know, or his research is built based on a faulty premise. You know, when we, especially with this, a lot of the things that we study, you know, in the foundation, I mean, mainstream is a very touchy thing because especially in the world of science, you know, if phenomena can't be explained, by so-called, as you say, you know, mainstream science, then it gets labeled as unscientific.
Right.
They determine their own, you know, what's scientific and what's not scientific. So then if they, once it's labeled as unscientific, they also say, well, it's unresearchable. And they go further, even when faced with the evidence is never enough. They'll just keep coming back and saying, you know, we demand more, we demand more, we demand more, when in fact some of the evidence is so overwhelming that proves the existence, for instance, of the mind being able to act independently of the brain, that these mainstream scientists just look at the hard data and refuse to accept it. So we talked about that before. I mean, Charlie Tott talks about scientism, you know.
Right.
So it's an ideology, you know, of its own, and it's and as you
well,
point out, it's harmful.
It's harmful for
progress.
Well, hugely, because the governments will only fund things that fall into mainstream science. So you're bravo to the scientists that are going ahead and doing the research with whatever funding they can get. But we've got to change the minds of these mainstream people, because we're never going to be able to get any further. We're running around in circles inside a square box, and we're not getting any place because of this.
Well, I guess, you know, thinking outside the box, I mean, thinking outside the box has been a catchphrase, and, you know,
since the 80s.
Yeah, and but in the world of science, it's really not well thought of when you dare to think outside the box.
And I think that that's going to change, and this may very well be a part of the shift that we're going to be experiencing, because I think people have been taught since the 80s and that catchphrase to think outside the box, and I think that's why you're getting these wonderful scientists that are finding the bacteria, that are finding these...
Right.
Holes. There's two mysterious bubbles coming out of the Milky Way. Can't explain it.
Right.
So they want to say it's not there. You know.
Well, fortunately, there have been these wonderful, you know, scientists and inventors throughout history that have dared to go outside the principles of what was recognized then as science, and they were persecuted ridiculed, and eventually, unfortunately, sometimes these people would pass away before the recognition came, but it turned out that they made tremendous advances in science, that without them, we'd still be in the dark ages. So, and we always talk about that as it relates to the afterlife, you know, because you can't summarily dismiss, you know, the possibility of an afterlife if you're a scientist until you make an honest effort to examine, you know, the data, and be open, you know, to progressive thoughts and foster some new research.
Right. It's the same concept of being innocent until proven guilty. These mainstream scientists want to say it doesn't exist, so therefore I'm not going to investigate it. You got to be open. You've got millions and millions of accounts of people having experiences. I mean, just your near-death experiences alone, what they come back with, it certainly merits investigating.
Yeah, well, I think it's part of it. It's human nature. You know, we live in a society where many times a great number of people don't like to, you know, go outside the boundaries. So, you know, no matter what realm we're talking about,
it's uncomfortable.
It could be fashion. It could be you know, economics. You know, you want to stick with the principles that you were taught in school, or you want to adhere to your religious beliefs, or you want to follow in your cultural, you know, traditions. And stepping outside of that, it's like jumping off a cliff to a lot of people. You know?
Right, but we need more cliff jumpers.
Yeah. Well, I guess time to go to a first break, and
yeah, and when we come back, we're going to hear more about the unseen world from our guest, Chris Carter. So
stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Hello, I am Lloyd Auerbach, parapsychologist and author. You can learn much more about life after death, precognition, mind-matter interactions, remote viewing, ghost hunting, and other psychic experiences and research through the acclaimed distance learning parapsychological studies program at HCH Institute. Our courses are audio-based with additional written and video material. Call HGH at 925-283-3941 or visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com. Our courses include The Search for Life After Death, Being Psychic, Psychokinesis and Precognition, Ghost Hunting, Theories and Models of Psychic Experience, and more. Taken singly or as part of the certificate program, these courses will enrich your knowledge of parapsychology and the range of psychic phenomena. You'll learn about being psychic yourself. Visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com or call 925-283-3941 for information about our individual distance learning courses and certificate program.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who is trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Chris Carter. Our sponsor is the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.wimbridge.org. Bob?
And our guest Chris Carter received his undergraduate and master's degrees in England at Oxford University, where he studied both economics and philosophy. His first book was Parapsychology and Skeptics. His current book is called Science and a Near-Death Experience, How Consciousness Survives Death. Chris teaches internationally. He's originally from Canada and currently lives in Venezuela. Hello, Chris. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hi, Bob. Thanks a lot.
You know, we were talking a little bit at the top of the show. There's just so much compelling data that in effect, you know, proves that our minds can act independently of our brains, and yet the so-called mainstream community continues to ignore the data. I mean, why do you suppose there's so much resistance to when we talk about things like this?
Well, That's a complicated question that I explored in my first book, and I also explore in my second book to some extent. It's something that's peculiar to Western societies, and it basically has to do with the historical conflict in the West between science and religion. I mean, as essentially as I argued in my first book, this debate is not primarily about evidence. Rather, the debunkers and the deniers are defending an outmoded worldview in which psychic phenomena are simply not allowed to exist. I mean, it's essential to realize that most of these deniers and phony skeptics are militant atheists and secular humanists. So for various reasons, these people have an ideological agenda which is anti-religious and anti-superstitious. One of the pillars of their opposition to religion and superstition is the doctrine of materialism. By that I mean the doctrine that all events have a physical cause and that therefore the brain produces the body. Now, if they conceded the existence of psychic abilities such as telepathy, and if they conceded the existence of the near-death experience as a genuine separation of mind from body, then this pillar of their opposition would crumble. In other words, materialism would be falsified, and their arguments against religion and superstition would therefore be weakened. And this explains their dogmatic denial of the evidence that proves materialism false.
I know you mentioned religion a bit. I think that it's fair to say that a great many people today, when you mention the word afterlife, they think of it purely in religious terms. But as you point out in the book, such beliefs predate organized religion, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It seems as though the belief in an afterlife dates back at least as far as the Neanderthals. They buried their dead with utensils and jewelry and flowers, presumably for use in the next world.
When we talk about our physical brains, I know one theory proposes that our brains in this physical existence, you know, act as a filter. So the brain sort of is hardwired to let in the type of information that's pertinent to our physical existence. And maybe some people, like mystics, are able to bypass this filter. Is this a theory that makes sense to you?
Yes, it does. I discuss this in my book. It's an old theory. It dates back at least to Henri Bergson. He was a philosopher in the 1800s. It was developed even further by the novelist Aldous Huxley. The idea is basically that our brains, in part, work as filters, filtering out perceptions and forms of consciousness that are not essential to our survival as biological organisms on the surface of this planet. People who've had experimented with certain types of recreational drugs will be familiar with the term, well, it expanded our minds, or these drugs expand our minds. That's essentially what Huxley was talking about, the expansion, the opening up of the doors of perception.
There's also a notion that our and I say the word consciousness, I guess it's interchangeable with our mind, but it's our consciousness is joined with the brain during physical life, but perhaps as in the near death experience, that joining is severed for a period of time in a near death experience, and maybe permanently when we physically die. Is that essentially what happens in a near death experience, do you think?
Well, it appears that way. I think that the evidence indicates that the actual relationship between the mind and the brain is that the brain works as a two-way receiver transmitter, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, and other times from mind to body, as in willed action. The rival hypothesis that the brain produces the mind, I think, has been proven conclusively false by the data of the near-death experience. What many people don't realize is that there's a lot of evidence to this effect, and, well, I examine it in detail in my book, Science and the Near-Death Experience.
Yeah. The near-death experience, I know one of the arguments that people had is that since, you know, Raymond Moody wrote the book Life After Life, at a time when, he coined the term, but he wrote it at a time when most people, lay people and professional people, were not familiar with the experience at all. And then a lot of the so-called mainstream scientists afterwards, when they hear about people going through near-death experience, they argued it away, saying, well, they must have read the book, and it's just they're just mimicking, you know, what they've read. So, I mean, did you find that as an obstacle in your research, that was that argument used, that people were just familiar with it and familiar with the term and somehow were making this stuff up?
Well, yeah, that's one of the first objections that I dealt with, you know, fantasy or wishful thinking. But yeah. The fact of the matter is the near-death experience has been reported in virtually all cultures long before Moody's book was published.
Yeah.
There's a great deal of similarities in the near-death experience between cultures. And also, the near-death experience is very similar for people of different religions and whether or not people were familiar with the literature on the near-death experience before they actually had one. So I think that argument is very weak.
Yeah. So as you go into great detail in the book, I mean, there are some differences among the various, you know, cultures in the world, but there are a lot of commonalities when the researchers go in and examine all the accounts. There are certain themes,
yes,
that just keep reoccurring.
Yes.
Is that, I mean, are there... what are some examples, you know, where they would be differently? I think I recall something to the effect that when the study was done in India, that the Indians didn't have as many life reviews as in the Western cultures. Was that correct?
Yeah, I examined reports from China, India, and tribal societies such as the Maori, the Native American. The main similarities across reports from different cultures appear to be the out-of-body experience and encounters with otherworldly realms and their inhabitants. The life review and the tunnel appear to be culturally specific. Life reviews are found in Western Chinese and East Indian experiences. They're not reported in accounts from societies of hunters and gatherers. The East Indians also typically don't report a life review.
Let's get into some of the objections, because you examine them in great detail in the book. I mean, I don't know if objection is the correct word, but one argument against the near-death experience.
Reality.
Yeah. Saying that it's oxygen deprivation. So people that are oxygen deprived have these hallucinatory moments that they later interpret to mean that they were traveling to other dimensions. So that doesn't quite hold up, as you point out, but tell us why.
Well, oxygen deprivation is probably the most common skeptical objection raised to the reality of the near-death experience as a genuine separation of mind from body. But the fact of the matter is that the effects of oxygen deprivation are well known, and they've been known for an awfully long time. Mountain climbers often experience it. Pilots flying at high altitude have experienced it. And it's well known that as the brain is deprived of oxygen, it simply ceases to function properly. As the oxygen supply is reduced, the person becomes progressively more disoriented and confused. And this is all in very sharp contrast to the clarity of thought and perception described over and over again in the reports of near-death experiencers. Also, pilots in training regularly undergo acute oxygen deprivation in flight simulators to make sure that they can get their masks on in time. And those who fail don't have near-death experiences. They experience confusion and disorientation sometimes trying to do things like land their simulated planes on the top of simulated clouds before losing consciousness. In my book, I also have the report of a man who experienced both oxygen deprivation and the tunnel well near death. He was a fellow named Alan Pring, and he flew with the British Royal Air Force during the Second World War. And while he was flying at high altitude, he experienced oxygen deprivation. Years later, he had a heart attack and had a classic near-death experience. And I quote Mr. Pring in my book. He said, quote, "I found myself floating along in a dark tunnel, peacefully and calmly, but wide awake and aware. I know that the tunnel experience has been attributed to the brain being deprived of oxygen. But as an ex-pilot who has experienced lack of oxygen at altitude, I can state that for me, there was no similarity. On the contrary, the whole near-death experience from beginning to end was crystal clear." That was Alan Pring, British Royal Air Force pilot.
Yeah, I think that you're so correct, and it's remarkable how that argument still is prevalent, because almost uniformly, I mean, every near-death experiencer, you know, reports either the same level of clarity or enhanced, you know, clarity in the experience, and it's
yes.
anything but hallucinatory and disoriented and unclear. So it seems to be a marked difference, and I don't know how that people still, you know, attribute it to deprivation. One thing you do get into deathbed visions in the book, and I know we've had those experiences, and I've always found it amazing when you see people who are physically and mentally disoriented and incapacitated, and sometimes it's just before death, and sometimes it could be a week or days before, they have these moments of physical improvement and tremendous clarity despite the condition that they were in before. So how does that, you know, relate? Is that the same principle that's going on in the near-death experience? Is their mind disengaging from the physical world?
Yes, it would seem to be that way. I mean, deathbed visions have been reported for centuries. They seem to have been very common in past times when people would tend to die at home without the influence of heavy anesthetic and tranquilizers. But they're also reported today, and I have a whole section in my book on deathbed visions. And you're right. It's frequently been reported for centuries, in fact, that as people approach death, if they've been confused or disoriented or even unconscious, they tend to have these moments of lucidity when they seem to regain all of their mental clarity, or perhaps even more than they've had. There's been cases of people who have been, they've been suffering from brain damage, sometimes for years, and shortly before death, they suddenly appear normal. And then when autopsies are done on their brains, they have severe brain damage. So it's a great mystery, which, again, reinforces the notion that the purpose of the brain, one of the purposes of the brain, is to work as a filter for consciousness.
And I guess it makes sense, because if we didn't have that filter, it would be pretty hard to navigate our daily lives if you had information coming in from all sources and perhaps many different dimensions. So, you know,
yes,
we
probably wouldn't care about certain things.
Yeah. The one thing that I've always, you know, wondered about, there's a great debate about whether our memories are actually stored in the brain, you know, or not. And we know that if they are stored in our brain cells, and it's a known fact that the cells in our bodies are constantly being replaced, why, you know, do our memories, you know, continue over long periods of time? Shouldn't they be obliterated?
Yeah, that's right. That's one argument against memories being stored in the brain. I think more relevant to that is the fact that for decades, brain scientists have tried to locate or find the location of memories in the brain. They've mostly done this by performing experiments on animals. What they will do is they will take a rat or an octopus or a dog or what have you, teach it a new trick, and then progressively remove sections of the animal's brain, trying to see, you know, where this memory was stored. And what happens is, as long as the animal isn't completely incapacitated, they can still remember. So, in other words, the attempts to find the location of memories in the brain have been a complete failure.
Hmm. What about what's your feeling about, you know, morphogenic fields like Rupert Sheldrake proposes? You know, where information can be gleaned, you know, collectively from these different fields.
Well. Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I discuss his ideas in depth in my book, specifically with regard to the possible extracerebral storage of memories. Without going into too much detail, Sheldrake has the idea that the growth and development of organisms is regulated by fields which are currently unrecognized by physics, which he refers to as morphogenetic fields. Morphogenic fields have been proposed by biologists for, well, decades. But Sheldrake takes the idea further. And one of his arguments is that there may be a very ridiculous reason for the inability of brain scientists to find the location of memories stored within the brain. They simply may not exist. Instead, he proposes that memories are stored in these fields, and the brain then tunes in to the morphogenetic fields, which are responsible for certain memories. And as I also mentioned in my book, this idea is testable. The idea, or I should say rather, that brain scientists have been unable to locate or find the location of where memories are stored in the brain. So instead, what some of them have said is that, well, perhaps memories are stored everywhere in the brain. But that's a completely untestable idea. How could you possibly test that? So that means it's not a scientific idea. It's not testable. It's rather a philosophical or metaphysical idea. But as I mentioned in my book, Sheldrake's ideas of morphogenetic fields are in fact very testable. And to the extent that they have been tested, they've passed most of the tests. So the idea that memories are stored outside of the brain is actually, I think, the only scientific hypothesis that we have with regards to storage of memories.
Mm. And of course, the evidence from mediumship studies, I mean, seems to indicate that, you know, discarnates can, they do retain, you know, not only memory but personality. So, you know, if
yes.
if their memories were lost with the death of the physical brain, this evidence should not exist. So I guess that's another form of evidence indicating that the mind and brain are not one and the same.
Absolutely.
So basically, when we talk about materialists, I mean that's what a dividing line is. The materialists believe that there is no difference between the mind and the brain, and so therefore survival is impossible because once the brain dies, memories cease to exist and we're obliterated. So that's when you interview all these scientists, when you come up across a materialist, it's very hard to get them to examine the data that you and others have uncovered, I would imagine.
Well, absolutely. I mean, as I said earlier, these deniers and debunkers are motivated by an allegiance to an obsolete worldview. Essentially, they're mostly militant atheists. They're motivated by a hatred of religion and superstition. And if they admitted to the existence of psychic abilities and the near-death experience as a genuine separation of mind from body, then, you know, the materialistic foundation of their worldview would crumble.
Yeah.
And they're afraid. They're afraid that the basis of their opposition to religion and superstition will therefore or thereby be eliminated.
Mm.
I think their fears are absolutely groundless, by the way. I mean, surveys show that most scientists accept the likely existence of psychic abilities and Surveys also show that scientists enjoy considerable prestige among the general public. So I don't think that society is likely to return to the Dark Ages anytime soon, just because of the acceptance of the near-death experience or psychic abilities.
Yeah, and you know, also I know that when we talk to people about certain psi phenomena and something incredible, which they seem to think is, you know, supernatural or paranormal happens, and they'll say things, you know, like I get goosebumps, or they'll say that, you know, I'm afraid of that. And essentially, a lot of them are afraid of it because they're taught to believe culturally and religious backgrounds that these things they're not for us to fool around with. They belong in the realm of God, you know, so to speak. And that's so it's not only the mainstream scientists, but a large percentage of the general public, I think, has a hard time, you know, grasping things they can't explain. You agree with that?
Partly. You mentioned scientists. I think I said earlier, most scientists are open-minded. And surveys have shown that most scientists accept the likely reality of psychic abilities such as telepathy or clairvoyance. The dogmatic skeptics, the phony skeptics, the pseudo-skeptics, those people are a definite minority in the scientific community. I mean, they're a vocal minority,
right?
But they're definitely a minority. And like I said before, the vast majority of them are militant atheists with an ideological agenda. And with regards to fear, I mean, sure, they're afraid of religion, they're afraid of the effects of religion on society, and they're also, you know, because of pride of knowledge or for whatever reason, they're afraid that their worldview or their opinions will be falsified. Mm. You know, we tend to treat our opinions as possessions.
True. We have been talking with Chris Carter, the author of Science and a Near-Death Experience. You can also visit his website, which is the same title as the book, www.scienceandtheneardeathexperience.com. We're going to go to a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this fascinating discussion with Chris. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
Heal your loss and grief through these spiritual hypnotherapy CDs. Titles include Talking with the Dead, The Inner Healer, Meeting Your Higher Self, and A Past Life Regression and Between Life Exploration. Dr. Holly Holmes Meredith is director of HCH Institute for Hypnotherapy and Psychospiritual Trainings. Go to hypnotherapytraining.com to sample and order her CDs. These CDs will empower you in your healing and transformation.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, our guest here tonight is Chris Carter. This show is sponsored by the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to Chris Carter, we have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. First, we'd like to mention the winners who were the ones who supported us along with everybody else who entered our raffle. We have five winners, each winning a one-hour medium phone reading. Those winners are Lynn G. from New York, Kathy J. from Colorado, Eileen B. from New Jersey, Robin C. from New York, and Janice S. from Connecticut. So you'll be, if we've mentioned your name or you recognize your name and you know you've entered, you'll be receiving a formal contact from us via email and or snail mail. Also, with these hard economic times upon us, some of our supporters write to say they love the radio show. They want to see it continue. They love the work of Forever Family Foundation, but they just don't have extra dollars these days to send our way. Even though we are a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do, and yet we want to do so much more. So this is how everyone can help without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that is taken out, and each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. But you don't have to stop there. If your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find your items in one of the 800-plus online stores, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Bob?
And we're back with Chris Carter, and the number here is 1-888-815-9756. Chris, I guess a large percentage of the people who have near-death experiences report encountering deceased relatives. And how common is the experience of them having to make a decision about whether to return or not?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Well, many people report encountering deceased relatives when they have a near-death experience. Is it common for them to be faced with that decision about whether to return? Is that something that most people encounter, or is some people, or is that a relatively obscure kind of experience?
No, it's being faced with decision is actually fairly common. but the decision is not necessarily theirs. Sometimes the decision seems to be made for them, either by a deceased relative who tells them they have to go back, or by a stranger, or by a mysterious being of light. So sometimes they make the decision themselves, and other times they're basically the decision is made for them.
Yeah, and of course those that make a different decision we never learn about, because it's only the people that make the decision to come back that we're able to gain reports from. So I guess
many times they come back against their will.
Yeah.
There was an interesting case. I mean, you could say, well, you know, many of these people are terminally ill, or they're very sick, and so it's not surprising that they would want to return to this world or this life. But there was one case of a 17-year-old. He was in the British Navy, and he was working on the ship's wiring, and he accidentally crossed some wires he shouldn't have crossed and was electrocuted, unconscious. While he was, his body at least, was unconscious, he had a near-death experience, a very interesting one actually, but he was basically on board of a train with other passengers going to some unknown location. He felt very happy, and he was wondering where they were going, and suddenly he found himself pulled away and back in his body. You know, this was a 17-year-old, a teenager with his whole life ahead of him, and he was angry at being back in his body. So it's not just the sick and the terminally ill that don't wish to return.
Yeah, and then I know it's not uncommon for those after they come back to start chastising the physicians, like, well, why did you do this to me? And for obvious reasons. I know there are also cases that are fascinating where I remember reading one case where somebody was floating above their body on the way to the hospital while they were in an ambulance. And at the same time as they were looking down on their body, they also saw the activity going on in the emergency room where they were headed. So I guess that shows that our consciousness can be in various places simultaneously. I would imagine you've had a few reports similar to that.
Not a person's consciousness perceiving events in different locations simultaneously. No, I haven't come across that, to be honest.
Yeah. What about the experience of going through a tunnel? I mean, do some describe that? I know I've heard it said that it's similar to the birthing experience, and I know that's probably an argument that was used saying that, well, now these are just memories that people have of when they were came into this world. Does that enter into your research at all? Do people describe that tunnel being similar to a birth canal?
That explanation, materialistic explanation, was proposed by astronomer Carl Sagan, who thought that memories of birth could explain the near-death experience. But, you know, it's been roundly criticized. It can easily be shown to run into trouble on several grounds. Hmm. I mean, at most, it's only an attempt to account for the tunnel, the light. It doesn't account for other aspects of the experience, such as visions of deceased friends and relatives, visions of another world. And it was dealt a severe blow by, of all people, Susan Blackmore. She compared the tunnel and out-of-body experiences of those born both normally, NDE experiencers born normally, and NDE near-death experiencers born via cesarean. And she found absolutely no significant difference in experiences between the two groups. So I would say that falsifies Sagan's theory.
Yeah, I would think so. There's also been attempts to explain it by as seizures. I know there were, temporal lobe seizures that would explain the near-death experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, seizures are caused by abnormal electrical discharges in the brain. And seizures in the temporal lobes of the brain may indeed cause auditory and visual hallucinations, memory flashbacks, feelings of deja vu, and even occasionally the feeling of being pulled out of the body. And so some people have speculated that it's electrical seizures that are a cause of the near-death experience. This theory has mostly been proposed, or is mostly due to Michael Persinger. He's a psychologist at Laurentian University in Canada, and he claims to have mimicked temporal lobe seizure phenomena by electromagnetic stimulation of the temporal lobes. He's even boasted that he can replicate all the major components of the near-death experience. But if you look at his data, his claim simply isn't true. The major effects subjects report are actually tingling sensations and vibrations. And in 2004, Persinger's research was dealt a serious blow when a Swedish team attempted to replicate his findings using equipment borrowed from his lab. There was a team in Sweden, and they tested, I think it was about 90 undergraduate students, and half of them were exposed to electromagnetic fields, and half were not. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They were using Persinger's equipment, and they had two groups of students. One group was exposed to the magnetic field stimulating the lobes. The other person had this helmet on as well. The other people had the helmet on as well, but right, they only went through the motions. And the students themselves did not know if they were going to be exposed to the magnetic fields or not.
Right.
And they also used a double-blind protocol so that neither the people running the experiment nor the subjects being tested knew first of all, what the experiment was testing, and also whether any particular subject was part of the test group or the control group. And they also they consulted Persinger's collaborator, a man named Stanley Coren, to ensure that the conditions for replication were optimal. So what did they find? Well, the Swedish team found absolutely no effect from magnetic fields whatsoever. The only characteristic that predicted what the subjects reported was personality. Those subjects who were rated highly suggestible on the basis of a questionnaire reported strange experiences when they were wearing the helmet, whether the current was on or whether the current was off. So in other words, Persinger's research was basically invalidated. And the thing is, then it raises the question, well, how closely do actual seizures resemble the near-death experience? Well, in my book, I have a quote from a fellow named Ernst Rodin. He's the medical director of the Epilepsy Center of Michigan and a professor of neurology at Wayne State University. In my book, I quote Dr. Rodin. He wrote, and I quote, "The hallmarks and nuclear components of near-death experiences are a sensation of peace or even bliss, the knowledge of having died and, as a result, being no longer limited to the physical body. In spite of having seen hundreds of patients with temporal lobe seizures during 3 decades of professional life, I have never come across those symptoms as part of a seizure."
Hmm.
End of quote.
That's pretty definitive. you know, I guess people can continue to produce, you know, one type of experience, you know, that's common to the near-death, the total near-death experience. But, you know, it doesn't really hold much weight, as you're saying, because just because you can reproduce one of the features doesn't explain how the other 10 features or 20 features take place. So I guess sooner or later,
yeah,
people are going to give up trying.
Yeah. I don't think the militant atheists are going to give up anytime soon.
No.
You have to remember that most of these deniers or debunkers, they simply ignore the data. Mm. And when they can't ignore it, they dismiss it.
Yeah.
When they can't dismiss it, they try to suppress it. In my first book, Parapsychology and the Skeptics, I provided several examples where these people, these so-called skeptics, have actively either attempted or succeeded in suppressing the data.
Which is a pretty sad state of affairs when you start suppressing the data, you know, I mean, in the name of science.
It's the... It's the antithesis of science.
Yeah. Of course, there's also the argument that the near-death experience is invalid because just by the very fact that they came back, they were never dead. So, you know, it doesn't hold any weight because it's not a true experience. But, you know, I know Bruce Grayson likes to say, you know, we keep moving the goalposts on what exactly death is. And I think you point out in your book that the definition of death differs in different countries. You could be dead in one country and not dead in another.
Yes,
which is pretty.
Well, I mean, different countries have different criteria, you know, of clinical death. I mean, they're very similar, but in practice, there's basically three criteria that are used to diagnose brain death, and the first is flat EEG reading, indicating non-functioning cerebral cortex. The second would be no blood flow to the brain. And the third would be a lack of brainstem activity. The brainstem, as you probably know, is the deepest and most ancient part of the mammalian brain. So by those three criteria, there's little doubt that some people have not only survived clinical death, but also have reported fully conscious experiences during the time they were clinically dead.
Do you think that... out of all, and I know you've studied many different types of psi phenomena. I mean, do you think that when we talk in terms of survival, that we have the most to gain from the study of the near-death experience? Is that the one type of experience that you think offers the best hope in possibly finding the mechanism that allows us to survive, you know, physical death?
Actually, not really. There are more impressive forms of evidence for survival than the near-death experience. I mean, it is whatever we say about people returning from clinical death. The fact of the matter is that people who had a near-death experience approached the frontier of death. They didn't actually cross it. Or they
Right.
didn't. They didn't actually cross an irreversible threshold. Put it that way. So there's other forms of evidence that provide more impressive evidence for the survival of mind after death of the body than the near-death experience. The near-death experience is interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sitting. That sounds like the makings of a new book.
Yeah, that's basically my third book.
Okay. We look forward to seeing that. You know, you wrote something at the end of the science and the near-death experience, and which I like. When you're talking about near-death experiences and deathbed visions, you said that a near-death experience was a sudden thrust into another world, whereas a deathbed vision was a gradual transition, and I thought that made a lot of sense.
Right.
Yeah. We have been talking with Chris Carter. You can find a link to his book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, How Consciousness Survives Death, on the Ferber Family Foundation website. It's an Amazon link. I recommend that you purchase this book. It pretty much will tell you everything that you ever wanted to learn about the near-death experience. It's researched thoroughly, and it's an enjoyable read, so I encourage you to do that. You could visit Chris's website at the same title as the book, www.scienceandtheneardeathexperience.com. And I hope that you'll join us again. You certainly are a wealth of knowledge in the subject, and we look forward to reading your new book. And when do you think that'll be out?
Well, it's hard to say. It'll probably be published sometime in 2011, probably near the end of the year. Perhaps
okay.
Around this time.
Well, we look forward to reading it, and please let us know, and I hope you'll join us again. And thanks for being with us this evening.
Sure, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. And
with that, I'd like to go right to my Gulf prayer.
Okay.
Because until the government fixes it up, I'm there praying for it. Now,
right.
Let's give energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures in Mexico Gulf by praying like this. To the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, corals, algae, and all creatures in our Gulf of Mexico, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank You, I Love You. That was by Masaru Emoto on May 9th, 2010, right after the disaster. And now we'd like to say...
Our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.